It's time for TWiT This Week in Tech. Wow, we got a great panel for you. Joining us from MarketWatch, it's Jennifer Booten. From Engadget, Devendra Hardawar. Jeff Jarvis is back from his travels. He's going to stop by. And we're going to go to Paris, because I think it's important today, with Patrick Beja. He'll give us the look from what's behind the scenes of what's going on in France. We talk about so much. It's going to be a great show. Stick around. This Week in Tech is next.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is TWiT, This Week in Tech, episode 536, recorded Sunday, November 15th, 2015. Kicking and streaming. This Week in Tech is brought to you by Stamps.com. Use Stamps.com to buy and print real U.S. postage the instant you need it, right from your desk. For our special offer, go to Stamps.com now. Click the microphone and enter TWiT. And by Casper, an online retailer of premium mattresses for a fraction of the price. Because everyone deserves a great night's sleep. Get $50 off any mattress purchase by visiting Casper.com/TWiT and entering the promo code TWiT. And by Carbonite. You never know when disaster will strike, at work or at home. Prepare for the unexpected with Carbonite. Protect digital files on your computer or server with secure, automatic cloud backup from Carbonite. Visit Carbonite.com today and get two free bonus months with the offer code TWIT. And by Citrix GoToMeeting, the powerfully simple way to meet with coworkers and clients from the convenience of your computer, smartphone, or tablet. Share the same screen and see each other face-to-face with HD video conferencing. For a 30-day free trial, visit GoToMeeting.com today. It's time for TWiT This Week in Tech, the show where we cover the week's news, tech news usually, but there'll be other news today, I believe. A big panel today because we added a token Frenchman. Patrick Beja is here, not Patrick. From PatrickBeja.com. He's the host of the Phileas Club, back, we're glad to say, your English language and news podcast, and Le Rendez-Vous Tech, your French language tech podcast.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me. It's kind of a last minute thing, but I'm fresh off the plane from Helsinki and jumping into a little bit of a, well, I thought it was going to be madness, but actually it seems pretty quiet, but we'll talk about that.
Yeah, I really wanted to get you on. I know it was very short notice, but I thank you for doing that. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Also with us, Jeff Jarvis, who's been traveling even more than Patrick. You've been all over the world, it seems like, since we saw you last. Yep, you're muted. Did we do that or did?
No, I did it. I did it so I could chomp on something. I was in Lagos in Johannesburg, and then the week before that, I was in Berlin, and the week before that, I think it was in Mexico City. So I'm
Three continents, all over the world. But it's so glad to have you on. We missed you on this week.
I'm glad to be here. I missed it terribly.
And you know, it's funny because I collect all week long stories. I go, oh, I want to hear what Jeff has to say about this. So I have 3 weeks of stories. I hope you're ready.
I am.
Also joining us from Engadget, Devendra Hardawar is here. Always a pleasure having you on, Devendra. Thanks for being here.
No problem.
Yeah.
It's fun.
Yeah. And actually, I have the iPad Pro in front of me, and Engadget just wrote an article saying, not so fast. It's not that fast.
Yeah.
It ain't a desktop. So we'll talk a little bit about
it. It's pretty crazy.
Yeah. We'll talk a little bit about that as well. And we have a newbie, and we want to be very gentle and kind for a few minutes anyway, to Jennifer Booten. She's a tech reporter at MarketWatch. She covers the markets. She covers finance. And there is a lot this week to talk, including Mark Andreessen dumping his Facebook, a significant portion of his Facebook stock. Jennifer, welcome to TWiT.
Hey, how are you doing?
Very nice
Thanks
to have you. I warned Jennifer ahead of time that we're all just a bunch of loud mouths, and you should just jump right in. Anytime you have
I'm prepared.
Yeah.
I'm ready.
Don't hold back.
I'm going to take you guys on.
Take us on.
Take us out.
Take us out. So, boy, you go on Facebook, French flags over faces. Facebook made that possible. They said they were going to do that. Last time they did it was the marriage equality Supreme Court decision. But they've made it very easy for Facebook users to show their solidarity. You see the Paris
peace sign, the Eiffel Tower peace sign on all over Twitter. Not that any of that makes a difference, but I think it's a, you know, I saw some people say, hey, you didn't do that when last week Beirut had, or the Russian plane was bombed. Why Paris? I think Paris is the capital of the world.
Not only that, Leo, but it was the first time that I didn't realize it, because I hadn't seen safety check before, because none of my friends were in the basically Pacific region where these things had happened, in Afghanistan and so on. And so this was the first time it was also a man-made disaster, not a natural disaster.
Yeah.
And really interesting stuff. I mean, Zuckerberg said, okay, fair criticism, and we should have done Beirut, and we will in the future. But they also have some very interesting criterion for this, that you can't really, in their view, use this for an ongoing war or epidemic, because there's no definition of safe.
Yeah.
In the case of a one-off event, a horrible event like this, it happens. There's a period of time and you can say I'm safe or I'm not, and you can have some veracity to that statement. So I think there was a lot of criticism of Facebook. I think it was misspent, just because if they'd done other man-made disasters, other terrorist activities, and didn't do Beirut, I think it'd be fair criticism. But the first time they did it was Paris. They're going to do it now. I think it was legitimate criticism, but legitimate answer by all means for the future. And this was the first time they did it for a terrorist event.
Patrick, you were in Paris, so you didn't get. But I heard from some people, Cedric Ingron, for instance, I saw that he was safe. Other friends, I have a friend who's in Paris today, was safe. And Facebook apparently knows where you are if you ever use it while you're there. And in at least one case, we'll send you a text message saying, are you okay? Let your friends know.
Wow.
So, as I was saying, I was in Helsinki, but I think there are two things on Facebook. There's the French flags, which feel, you know, it's one way to express support. It feels a little bit gimmicky sometimes. And certainly it did feel a little bit, as a Parisian, it felt like, yes, it's wonderful to see all of this, but at the same time, what you were saying earlier, they didn't do it for other disasters, including, you know, some terrorist attacks, the thing in Beirut last week and things like that. So that did feel a little bit, okay, it's you know, different approaches to different people, I guess.
Though, in America, at least, we feel a real bond with France.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it is, you know, the reality is there is some amount of proximity of culture, and you know, it feels more, you feel more intimately hit when it's a country that is closer to you culturally and historically and all of this. Then it's not an excuse, but I guess it's an explanation. But certainly for the Are You Safe tool, I have to say that this was immensely useful, including for myself. It's hard to realize how useful these things are until you're actually in the middle of a situation. I was able to signal everyone in one fell swoop that I was okay, but mostly I was, you know, it was a small area of the city. And of course, you know, 100-300 people hit is enormous, but there's still a very small chance that you're specific friends in a city of 2 million
people. You're still going to worry,
people,
though, Patrick,
right? Yeah, exactly. And
how many friends of yours checked in? How many friends in your world?
Everyone.
It's a long list. Like, yeah.
There was everyone. A number. In my world, it was 12 people.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Paris. So
what was your number?
Do you remember? All of my friends who live in Paris checked in, and for everyone, it was a relief when, you know, it was really the signal that they were safe was if they had put the I'm safe on Facebook. We were like, that was what I was going to check. It was like, okay, Amy, of course, you know, the very close friends you're going to call, but there are a few people that you're not necessarily going to call 100 people. So you think of the people who live in the city, and you go check Facebook. And once they've checked in, they said they're safe. It's seriously a big relief. And especially since I was in Helsinki, we had SIM card problems, and I was using a Finnish SIM card in my phone. So I couldn't be reached by phone. I had to check on the internet, and I had to choose, do I want to be reachable on my phone or do I want to have access to the internet? Obviously I chose the internet, but so Facebook was really the way, you know, after I switched cards to call my mother and, you know, my parents and my very close friends, Facebook, absolutely the check-in tool. I can see how it's invaluable. Like, seriously, it provides an incredible service to the community in that case.
Yeah, it's also a great example. But just quickly, it's a great example of how Facebook's using its platform for good, because normally all we hear, right, is about how Facebook is taking over people's privacy, you know, or eroding our privacy. And this is a really great use of the platform that's not just like not just publicity for Facebook, yes. Right?
Yeah, Jennifer?
And at least it's a useful tool, whereas mm-hmm. I feel like if people are just changing their profile pictures to the French flag, I think it's nice, but it doesn't really serve a purpose besides some people saying that they're behind it. But then what else are they doing, you know, besides changing right. for 1 second their picture? Yeah. But the tool, the survival tool, saying you're safe, I think that has served a good purpose in past natural disasters. Look at the earthquakes, for example, in Afghanistan, and it allows people and even people, for example, who are on vacation there. And I have a friend who is in Europe right now, and if they had been in Paris at the time, that would have been a useful purpose of that tool as well.
Well, even more so, the Twitter tag porte ouverte, which means door is open, that was used by Parisian residents to signal that they would be willing to put up somebody who's seeking safety or even just somewhere to stay in Paris on Saturday night. And that's
amazing at every one of these instances, we find new uses for this and the scale changes. 4 million people, according to Facebook, used the safety check. Wow. And then, of course, that's not all there is. I don't want to say his name because he shared it with just his friends, but somebody I think you and I both know was in Paris, was to go to a birthday party for his friend at La Belle Equipe. His mother called. As a result, he did not go.
Wow.
He is alive, but all his friends died there.
Wow.
And he tells this story on Facebook in a way that you know, what can you do but your heart pour out to him for what his loss, but your gratitude that he's there. That's what Facebook enables. It's the connection. I just wrote a column for the New York Observer remembering Katrina, which was NOLA.com is a site I helped start back in the day, where people used it. They used the forums. They used Craigslist. They used whatever they could to tell people they were safe or to connect with people. Facebook's case, this is a very specific purpose-driven application they created that does a job. And they turn it on to do that job, and they turn it off when they don't. And yeah, that might have gotten some hassle, but I think it's pretty amazing that they really anticipated. They said it was inspired by the Tokyo tsunami or the Japanese tsunami and the reactor problems in Japan. That's what inspired them to make the safety check, and how the safety check is now used and how they anticipated the use case and thought of it. It's pretty amazing.
I think Twitter should implement something like that as well. I wouldn't be surprised if they did in the near future. And that hashtag, porte ouverte, basically open doors, just for people to understand, there was a lot of confusion in the beginning of this thing. We started having reports of, you know, gunfire and attacks, but we didn't know how many were there. There were people who were staying close to, you know, who were... It was a Friday night. So in Paris, people, you know, like in every city, you go out, you have drinks with friends, and people were close to those areas and they didn't want to stay in the streets. So that was also heartwarming. I think a few, some taxi cabs also just turned off the meters and just drove people home because people didn't want to stay in the streets. They didn't want to take the subway. But the porte ouverte was nice, of course. I think there was also one thing that was still related to technology, but kind of heartbreaking in the next day. You could see people sending tweets asking to be retweeted because they hadn't heard from some of their friends or family members that they knew were at those places that had been attacked. And you would see those photos being retweeted many, many times. And you knew that there was a very good chance that person was dead, and it was kind of putting it in front of your face. It was heartbreaking. There was also another thing. A couple of teenagers started accounts basically broadcasting those pictures of people that they wanted to have, that other people wanted to have news about. And there were a couple of kind of mishaps I'm guessing they were kids, but one of the people who was there at the concert, My understanding is that they pretended to not be, they didn't call their parents or something. And they, once they saw, you know, that retweet being retweeted 1,000 times, they answered to it and they were like, oh my God, I got 1,000 retweets. And you're like, what are you thinking? But they were, very young people. And then one of those accounts created to retweet these, basically announcements, was saying, this person has not been heard of, or, you know, this person was killed in the attacks. One retweet is one piece of support. And so you would see people retweeting this in the very, I guess it's lack of taste. I guess it's teenagers. They're not sure exactly how to handle all of this. And but
this is going to happen. I think what's interesting about it, though, is contrary to the past, where a news story like this was really at arm's length, you watched it on CNN. Thanks to social media, it's really much closer to home for everybody. And even if you don't know anybody on Safety Check, but all you have to do is scan Twitter during these events, and really, in a way that the news media is incapable of doing, have a direct personal experience of this. I think that's got to be good.
Actually, I have to add something. Sorry, I'm speaking a lot, but
is your story.
That's why you're here.
Yeah, yeah. But I have to say, I can't count the number of people that sent messages, mainly through Twitter, because, you know, Facebook is going to be more personal and people you actually know. But on Twitter, for someone like me who's a semi-public person, there were so many people that sent messages of support and just, you know, we're thinking of you and we're with you and we're happy you're fine. And that every one of those messages counted. You know, it was everyone made me feel a little bit less alone and a little bit more supported. And even if it's people you don't necessarily know, you know, I went to bed, I decided not to watch the things that as they were unfolding, it was the evening for us on Saturday evening or Friday. I can't even remember. I decided not to watch because I knew it was going to be some kind of unproductive, almost voyeuristic thing where you were going to worry more than you were going to be informed. So I just decided, you know, I'm going to go to bed and we'll see what happens tomorrow. And at that point, it was, I think we were estimating about 20 dead. And I woke up the next day and it was the toll was almost 130 dead and 200 people hurt. Sorry, I'm getting a little bit emotional, but so I wake up and I see that toll and my heart just sank. You know, it was really hard to just read that I thought it was going to be 20, maybe 30 people, and it was 130 people. And along with that, there were so many messages of people expressing support that it made it, I don't know, it refueled my heart, I guess, or my soul. And again, with the Facebook French flag on avatars, it's really a dual feeling. It's both at the same time you kind of feel it's, you know, what does that achieve? But also you understand that people who are hearing this, they want to show their support, and you're on the internet. What are you going to do? You know, you can't go and shake someone's hand who's 10,000 kilometers away. So it's also nice to see that people are actually doing it and that they want to tell you, we feel for you. So It does count, I guess, is what I'm saying. It's not going to solve the world's problems, but it does count. And yeah, I could talk about this for a while.
And as somebody who did that, both put the French flag on my Facebook and put the Paris peace, the Eiffel Tower peace sign on my Twitter, it makes us feel a little bit better because you feel helpless in a situation like this. And so I think people want to do something. And that's something, it's small, but I feel like that also makes us feel a little bit better. And we hope that it makes our French friends feel better. Boy, you looked at did you see what Amazon did? Which was quite dramatic.
French
flag with solidarité.
Yeah. There were a couple of initiatives like this.
Do you feel like that's just commercialism, or is that that's heartfelt? I feel like that's heartfelt. That doesn't.
No, I think, yeah, I think it's a little bit of maybe a little bit of both, but I don't think the heartfelt feeling is fake. There was also Uber that made their little cars into French flags, which was a little bit tacky, but you know.
Well, it's Uber. Again, what do you expect?
I guess so.
Uber's always going to do the bro thing. You know, whatever the bro thing would be, that'll be what they'll do.
But what are you going to do, right? That's the kind of things you can do. And there were a lot of other things, you know, maybe not as tech related, but it made a lot of people think, you know, we've had a lot of discussions about refugees coming from Syria. And a couple of people were saying, including myself, you know, this is so dramatic for us. And there's been a lot of discussions about the refugees, you know, we don't have enough space for all of them and blah, blah, blah. And you're like, what if this is your everyday? Right. How long until you actually want to leave and go somewhere else? And I guess the other thing is the other shoe, which is going to drop fairly soon, I guess, is how are this is going to be translated into policies and possibly make policies even more encroaching on privacy. Although I don't know how much farther they can go with what they've done after the Charlie Hebdo.
We are definitely going to talk about while from normal people you saw heartfelt outreach and stuff from governments, of course, the immediate reaction is, oh, how can we use this to our advantage? Here's YouTube. This is interesting because, of course, YouTube would like to be the next CNN. I mean, they would really prefer that instead of going to Twitter or CNN or Facebook, that you would go to YouTube. And they have not only the Let We Stand With Paris, but they have a button that says Latest News. This is interesting. This is the first time I can remember YouTube using a news story is an opportunity to promote itself as a news source. And that's not the first thing I'd think of is going to YouTube.
No.
I would have never thought to go to YouTube.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah. I think they'd like you to think of it. Please think of us as a news source. And you know what? They can reinvent themselves. If there's one thing that's for sure true is nothing is permanent in the internet.
And there's been, you know, most of the news stations use YouTube to host their content. I mean, in France, a lot of them are going to be using Dailymotion because it's French, but there's still a lot of them also going to YouTube. So I think it's a relatively easy affair from the YouTube engineers to develop something.
It's interesting like that this. When I clicked Learn More, what I got was France 24. There's no other brands on this. I don't know if France 24, how that happened. If there's a relationship between YouTube and France 24, is that a state-run television network or is it a private?
Yeah,
network?
It's basically a state-run.
So that seems like a logical choice then.
Yeah, it's somewhat separate from the state, but the it's financed mostly from the TV contribution that every person who owns a TV pays.
All right, so it's like the BBC. It'd be a natural thing to go to, I guess.
Yeah. And it's the one that is international facing. So they have, it's kind of more like CNN and well, I guess BBC as well. They have a French channel, an English channel and an Arabic channel, actually.
Yeah.
So they do everything
in
three languages.
The other thing I did almost immediately is, you know, the first thing that struck me is, well, I want to understand this better. What is this all about? Now, I guess you don't call it ISIS or ISIL anymore. We call it Daesh.
Yeah.
Is that the new thing? That's the Arabic initials for the Islamic State.
Well, that's actually a very, there's a funny story behind it.
This is not what they want to be called. Apparently, it's annoying to them to call him Daesh.
Which is why we want to call him.
Like, that's going to, let's annoy a terrorist. That's smart.
Let's all do that.
Let's all just be as annoying as we can. Troll the terrorists.
All of the politicians are, I don't know how purposeful it is, but I'm sure they know that, you know, the difference between the two words, but all of the politicians are calling them Daesh.
Well, the thing that was interesting to me is I wanted to know more. My thought was why are they doing this? What's their point of view? And I was able very quickly to find some really good resources. One from The Atlantic, which had a cover story on this in March. That was
Matthew Iglesias wrote a great piece on Vox explaining the case for using
each. Yep. Ezra Klein retweeted a few videos. And then Der Spiegel had an interesting article tying the top leadership of Daesh to former Iraqi leadership under Saddam Hussein, which I thought was interesting. So this is the internet is really can shine in a time like this in some very interesting ways. However, when we take a break, when we come back, let's talk about how government reacts to this. And sometimes that's a little more disturbing. Our show today, we got a great panel, and I'm sorry it's so big, and we've got so many people. That means we're all going to have to take turns, and boy, we picked a bad time to break in Jennifer Booten from MarketWatch, but you're great, and I'm not worried about you, but I apologize for the size of the panel, but there's a lot to talk about, obviously, with the events in Paris. Devinder Hardawar, also here from Engadget. The return of Jeff Jarvis. From Parts Unknown, I was following your travels. There's another one where the internet's great. I was following your travels and your frustrations on Facebook, and it was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun. And thank you, Patrick Beja, for joining us at the last minute to give us the Parisian perspective.
My pleasure.
Our show today brought to you by Stamps.com. This is the time of year where you do not want to go to the post office because that's amateur. It's amateur hour at the post office. Lots of people go there once a year to mail all their Christmas gifts. And if you're running a business and your mailing is part of your business, you don't want to go there. You want to do it all from your desk. That's what Stamps.com is so great for. Anything you could do at the post office, you could do at Stamps.com. You have a digital scale. They're going to give it to you, a USB scale that will calculate exact postage for any letter, any package, any class of mail, including media mail. It's easy to set up. You print these labels that are professional looking, or you can print right on an envelope with your company logo, the return address. The addresses are populated automatically from, if you're an eBay seller, from the eBay site or from Amazon or from Etsy. It makes you look like a pro, and it saves you time, and all you need is your computer, your printer. You don't need a postage meter, special ink, or anything like this. It makes a small business look like a big business. There are no long-term leases. There are no hidden fees. There's no postage meter. There's no postage meter ink is more expensive than inkjet printer ink. That tells you it's 100 times more expensive. Plus, of course, they charge you to reset, and they charge you processing fees. If the postage changes, you got to bring it to the post office. You don't want a postage meter. This is the modern world. This is welcome to the 21st century. You even get discounts you can't get at the post office. And it'll automatically fill out the customs forms, the certified mail, the return receipt, even send an email saying, hey, your package is on the way. I love Stamps.com. Here's the deal. Go to Stamps.com. Click the microphone in the upper right-hand corner. And use our promo code TWIT, T-W-I-T. You're going to get a $110 bonus offer, $55 in free postage. Yeah, $55 in free postage. You get the digital scale, and you get a supply kit and a four-week trial of Stamps.com. It's all great. It's all good. Once you use it, you'll never stop. Stamps.com. We thank them for their support of This Week in Tech. Don't forget our offer code is TWIT. So, of course, immediately government responds to this. Glenn Greenwald with a very emotional piece in The Intercept this morning, written at 4:23 a.m., so I think he was up all night, exploiting emotions about Paris to blame Snowden and distract from actual culprits who empowered ISIS. Isn't that, it's almost shameful that a variety of news people, government officials, he says, former Bush-Cheney apparatchiks, people with deep ties to private NSA contractors, all saying, hey, thank you, Snowden. When, of course, as Glenn points out, Snowden didn't tell us any, didn't tell the bad guys anything about how we observe them. He let us know that we were also in the electronic dragnet. And anybody who saw Zero Dark 30 knows that even Osama bin Laden, as early as 2003, knew not to use the cell phone or the internet. Terrorists know that. Here's an article, February 5th, 2001, USA Today. Terror groups hide behind web encryption.
We're going to see attacks on encryption now that are just...
It's already started.
Yep, it has.
New York Police Chief Ben Bratton, let me see if I can find that article, says, well, you can bet that the bad guys in Paris were communicating. I'd like to know what kind of phones they had because they were communicating with encrypted technology They're just one more dark.
So actually, the latest, I don't know if they're rumors or substantiated, but they're apparently, it's mentioned as a possibility. So good luck to the police chief. Apparently, the latest rumor is that they were using the PlayStation network on PlayStation 4.
That's not the first time I've heard that that's been done before.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
They're not being monitored as, you know, I guess just people didn't think of it. But I'm sure that now people, you know, the government officials are going to go knock on Sony's and Microsoft's door and try to get some visibility into that as well. But obviously, I think the issue is they're always going to find something else or use some encryption that it's easy to do it. The problem that we're being faced with now, there are a couple of things. First of all, after the Charlie Hebdo attacks, there was a very strong movement in the French government to try and empower the police forces to have access to more information on everyone. And, you know, basically formalizing and legalizing, I think, what they had been doing for a while anyway. So that's why they were pushing it so much. That's the way I look at it. And it did go through. So I don't know what more they could be doing. The other thing is, it's the big problem with these kinds of attacks is that it seems that most of the time, if not all of the time, they're perpetrated by people who are already known by the
that's what always blows my mind. They've process, interviewed right? these guys. They know they're there. Yeah.
So they are people who are, you know, they have giant lists of people that they should be surveying, who are already being surveyed anyway, right? That they have the proper judicial approval. They have everything. And they are, if they had the resources for it, they would be following all of these people anyway. And the way they're pushing, I think, because they just don't know what to do and they want to appear to be doing something. I don't think there's incredibly malicious intent in there. Maybe that's me giving them the benefit of the doubt. But what they're doing is pushing it to say we have to be able to survey everyone. But really, I'm not sure how efficient it would be, because the people that need to be surveyed already know who they are and they have the right to survey them anyway. So that's where the disconnect comes from. And that's where people think, although I have to say, and I'll finish on this, when I heard about the attacks immediately, as tech literate as I am, I had a few minutes of, you know, I thought, and I have been fighting those laws very, you know, publicly to my the best of my ability, I've been saying they are bad laws. But for a few minutes, I was thinking, you know what, just let them spy on everyone. I give up. If there's a modicum of a fraction of a percent that it will help, let them do it. And then, you know, I had to remind myself that it actually...
It's tempting.
Doesn't matter. It just doesn't matter. It's so tempting. Imagine people who don't know.
Here's what... it's not Benjamin Bratton. He's an actor. It's Bill Bratton, chief. New York Police Commissioner said this morning on ABC This Week with George Stephanopoulos, ISIS taking advantage of the technology that the head of the FBI has been complaining about. I've been complaining about going dark, the ability to go dark. I think you're going to see that playing a significant factor in this event. I'm very interested to see what types of phones they were equipped with, what types of apps they had on their phones. Were they, in fact, even in communication with each other at all? And then on Face the Nation, I guess he was making the rounds, he said, these apps, these devices that now allow these terrorists to operate without fear of penetration by intelligence services, this is the first example of this, which, of course, is not true. We have gone blind as a result of the commercialization and the selling of these devices that cannot be accessed either by the manufacturer or, more importantly, by us in law enforcement. Even equipped with search warrants and judicial authority, this is something that is going to be needed to be debated very quickly, because we cannot continue operating where we are blind. So I think you're going to see the drumbeat once again. In Great Britain, apparently, David Cameron has kind of backed down on his plan of enforcing backdoors in encryption, realizing it would harm the economy, if nothing else. But then these things happen, and people... people get the political wherewithal to pursue this once again. So I wouldn't be surprised at all.
I think this is why these, you know, shows like this one are so important. And it's so important that the audience of our shows is informed and also informs people around them, not in an aggressive way. You know, you don't have to go all Snowden.
But what do you say? So give us some ammunition. What do you say? And I think this is just as you experienced a very real concern. Yeah, but how do we catch these guys? What do you say to somebody who says, we got to give them these powers? If we make it, you know, they have to get a warrant. What's wrong with that?
That's the problem. The problem is when they don't have to get a warrant, which is what is happening in France now. It's unwarranted. There's some kind of weird weird organization that is supposed to have some oversight, but it's nominated by the presidency or, you know, the government itself. There's no counterpower there. And they are able, in theory, to absorb all of the information and, you know, to basically do what the NSA and other intelligence organizations have been doing in the US, and that has been exposed by Snowden. And what we can say, I think, is what needs to happen is police work on the people that are already in the view field, the field of view of the information agencies, and bringing everyone in the country into that field of view is actually not going to help. These are two separate issues. Again, I think it's very important to understand whether or not the people who made those attacks had crossed the paths of the intelligence agencies at some point. And it seems that the first elements of the investigation seem to indicate that that is the case. They were people who were very prepared. They were professionals. They had gone to Syria and probably, you know, they had been there and had come back. That's the first elements that we've seen. So really, when you're expanding the power of these agencies to gather information from the entire country and people who have no relationship with these specific people, you're not helping at all. You're just making everyone's life, you're just attacking everyone's privacy. And if the issue is that you have to be able to be more, to get access to information faster and more efficiently, that's not a problem. I think we're all in agreement that that should happen. If you have someone that you're gathering information on that calls someone else, or that has some kind of contact with someone else, and you want to have information on that person, sure, just, you know, get a warrant or even get a special powers of something and get their information very quickly. That's fine.
But we've talked about this, and Devendra, you probably can comment on this. It's also dangerous to put back doors in this stuff for other reasons, right?
I mean, for sure. Like other hackers could get access to those back doors as well. You know, it opens up all sorts of interesting doors and dangerous doors for our software, and it kind of defeats the purpose of having decent encryption anyway, too.
I often, though, wonder, especially the wake of the passage of CISA, if how committed companies like Apple, Facebook, and Google are really to, I know that they very prominently and publicly said, oh, CISA's a bad idea. But at the same time, I feel like in the behind the scenes, they were saying, yeah, but it wouldn't be such a bad thing if you passed this. CISA was, of course, the cybersecurity law that allows companies to share information about attacks, cyber attacks, with each other and with the government without warrant. And most importantly, I think for these companies, without liability. They can't be sued if they give your information. I love it that Apple says your stuff is, on this iPhone is encrypted. No one can get it. We can't even get it. We can't give it to law enforcement. But I wonder if that's just lip service, and if behind the scenes Apple is saying, I mean, they have to adhere to U.S. law, right?
Mm-hmm.
Do you trust your iPhone, Devendra? Do you feel like no one can spy on what you're doing on your iPhone?
I mean, it's tough. I kind of assume that, you know, if somebody in the government really wanted to get access to something, they could. But I also have like a corporate profile on my iPhone, so I can access my enterprise mail, and my IT department, I know, can do a lot of things on my iPhone, but I do it because I need to get access to my work mail. We make these concessions all the time, but the scary things are, what can the government do that maybe Apple or other companies aren't telling us about.
Yeah, I you know, here's the information that you were talking about, Patrick. How Paris ISIS, let's call them Daesh terrorists, may have used PlayStation 4 to discuss and plan attacks. This information comes from Belgium. The federal Home Affairs Minister Jean Jambon. Does that mean ham?
said, yes, it does.
Okay. You know those Belgians. They're weird. Jean Jambon said that the PS4 is used by ISIS agents to communicate, and it was selected due to the fact that, here it comes again, it's notoriously hard to monitor. He said it's even more difficult to keep track of than WhatsApp.
So let's ban PS4s everywhere.
Yeah. it's Sony's problem. Sony's fault. What do? They go into a World of Warcraft game? I think they might. According to documents leaked by Snowden in 2013, the NSA and CIA embedded themselves in World of Warcraft to infiltrate virtual terrorist meetups.
And I think that's what you have to do. You have to have people actually. What are you going to do? Are you going to actually
monitor everything?
I think one of the pieces of information that came out of this was that obviously they don't want to admit to it, but they have so much information they don't know what to do with it. I guess it's for reviewing after the fact if something happens.
If I were a terrorist, I probably wouldn't be in World of Warcraft or Call of Duty. I'd do something like Super Mario Kart. It seems less likely that anybody be looking for me there, right?
I think they're going to continue to find ways to innovate, right? They're going to try to, they understand now a bit of what the government's doing in terms of monitoring them, and they're going to get creative. They have to, and whether it's going on PlayStation or finding a different way or trying to stay off the internet as much as possible, they're going to do it.
And bottom line, it's not okay to weaken privacy, to weaken encryption, to give bad guys backdoors to our stuff because you have a hard time following these terrorists.
Right.
It doesn't matter. You're still going to have a hard time anyway.
Yeah. You know? I think they're just going to go back to phones. They're going to call each other on the phone. And,
yeah, for crying out loud, say, on the wire. When was the wire? Yeah. Even the bad guys on the wire knew you don't talk on the phone. For crying out loud.
They'll use Windows phones. Nobody would ever guess that.
Oh, all right. Or, you know, maybe that BlackBerry Priv. if I were a terrorist, there's where I'd go with it. BlackBerry Priv.
No one would suspect.
Not in a million years. All right. I don't want to belabor the point, but I think there are a lot of great and interesting tech angles, and I'm glad that we could get you in here, Patrick, to give us the first-person experience. Because what's it like in Paris tonight?
I just came from the airport.
Was it difficult to get into and out of?
No. It was fine. I think it's going to be relatively normal. I think there's a lot of people who are. My concern is not with Paris itself. I think Paris is going to be fine. We already had Parisians back in the, you know, terraces yesterday, basically flipping people off when they were, I think BuzzFeed did an article going to terraces asking, what do you have to say to terrorists? Or like, how are you living your life? And they were, you know, giving virtually terrorists the finger, and they were enjoying their coffees and beers at the terraces. But the real concern is more on the policy side of things, obviously the privacy things and how things are going to evolve with Assad and the military and the privacy options and things like that. But Paris seemed relatively normal. It was easy to get in. There weren't any issues at the airport.
That's not normal at De Gaulle. It's always difficult.
The worst airport, I'll tell you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Fascinating to me is that, and this is actually raises an interesting question for BuzzFeed. How do you simultaneously do a viral listicles and real news? And they're trying to do both. And it
actually, I can't remember if it was there that I saw that article.
But there are absolutely articles like that. Mm-hmm. On BuzzFeed. Yeah.
And there was one about the rumors. And it was a great and not, you know, semi-investigative work where they were saying making a list of all of the rumors that were floating around and why.
Well, here's one I fell for. The Eiffel Tower went dark. No, didn't happen.
Exactly.
I fell for that one. I thought for sure that happened. At least I didn't retweet it. They turn them off at 1 in the morning anyway.
I just saw stupid Washington Post did that, saying people were fooled. And the example they use is that certain parody account that I refuse to name.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah. Was he fooled? Let's hope he was fooled.
No, he was. So they got pawned by a pawner.
That's terrible.
Jeez.
That's terrible.
Washington Post, for God's
Actually, this
sake.
Is good. This is okay. I'm gonna take it back. You're right. This is a great listicle from BuzzFeed. The things that people believe but didn't happen. Yeah. I think that's actually kind of an appropriate place for them to.
Well, it's more useful than some of the other listicles, but it's weird when you go to the BuzzFeed homepage that they're still highlighting the really virally types of articles, and you have to click another button to go to BuzzFeed News.
The news part.
And I feel like, after a certain point, maybe you just want to, let's just call BuzzFeed News something else, because it really is something totally different than what BuzzFeed ever was.
I agree, Dimitri.
They really are getting more serious, though. I was just thinking that the other day that I feel like BuzzFeed to start was always just listicles and things like that. And I remember maybe 3 years ago sharing, 20 things to do when you're under 30, things like that. And now I really think I go to BuzzFeed more for the news.
Is that Jennifer's mic that's kind of starting to crackle? I don't know. Maybe unplug it and plug it back in. Sometimes that happens. Okay, admittedly, this isn't really good news, but it does. It's actually a perfect listicle because it's timely.
Yeah,
it's about the news, informs you, and you can mock somebody, which is really what it's all about, right?
Yep.
This picture doesn't show a march in Germany expressing solidarity with the French, like DJV girl tweets. It's actually from an anti-immigration event in January. Hey, one march looks much like another. I don't blame her for getting that wrong. Were the terrorists, do we know, using Twitter and Facebook? I know that there was some jubilation from various Daesh accounts on Twitter.
No, I don't know that they were. I think it's taken a little bit, I think, a day for Daesh to actually claim responsibility for those attacks.
Right.
I don't think there's been a huge amount of activity. I think actually we didn't have a lot of information on the terrorists, and which led to some pretty ethical work by the journalists. My first fear was that they were going to plaster the airwaves with their, faces and names in the way that is the most harmful to.
Let's not do that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But since we don't know, basically most of it's terrible, but most of them blew themselves up. So we really didn't know anything, and we still don't know much at this point. So, and I don't think they used social media a lot. My theory, and this is completely personal, I'm not even sure how much all of this is geared towards the West or towards France. I think Daesh is currently in a relatively tight spot. They're losing ground to some of their enemies in locally, and this is a recruitment tool that they made, to distract the world from the fact that they're not as powerful as they were a few months ago. And to get people to join them in some parts of the world that are more susceptible to these kinds of things.
The nice thing is you can recycle when these events happen close together. A lot of these tweets and images are from the Charlie Hebdo attack, including this one, which I saw quite a bit of on Twitter. That's from January. That's not not recent, although the sentiment still applies. Uber did not.
Did you guys get the New York Times update, push update today about France attacking Syrian ISIS targets in Syria? That was a little chilling too, because it felt like, oh, okay, of course, if this were a novel or a movie, like this is the plot point, advancing very quickly. And that was kind of scary because it seemed also very, very typical.
The news is a video game now, and we're all players, which I don't think is necessarily a good thing.
Yep.
Let's take a little break and we can talk about nice things. iPad Pro, a 4-inch iPhone, things like that. The Steve Jobs movie, bombing.
Which was great, but it bombed,
Did you like it, Devendra?
I loved it.
Really?
Really?
And most of the tech world doesn't. And I wrote a long article in Engadget about like why a lot of people are wrong. But it's I thought it was a tremendous film, but it's, you know, it's not completely accurate. But most biopics aren't, you know.
Right. And you enjoyed it as a work of art.
As a piece of art, yeah. Like it's much more interesting than just like trying to rehash Steve Jobs' life from beginning to end. It's a really artistic, dramatic, almost Shakespearean take on that story.
It felt very Shakespearean. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I, however, am delighted it has, failed and is out of the theaters.
Me too.
I think it was a piece of junk. So we can disagree about that.
Well, it's, you know, it kind of comes down to, and I think that reasonable people can disagree, comes down to whether you like Aaron Sorkin or not.
Yes.
You know, I like early Aaron Sorkin, mm-hmm. less fond of late Aaron Sorkin.
Yeah. Although The Newsroom, I know a lot of people hated The Newsroom. Yeah. See, The Newsroom is a lot of fun, but it's not like the most accurate portrayal of the news.
You know, not even close. And it's sexist to boot.
And The Social Network was dreadful.
The Social Network was a much bigger problem. You know? The Social Network, Oscar nominee and Oscar winning in many, you know, in many respects, was far more, you know, fantastical about its story than Steve Jobs was. Whereas that Steve Jobs kind of took real events and just mashed them all into very tight time frames. But it was a lot more true to Steve Jobs than The Social Network was to Zuckerberg or that whole story.
It's funny that you mentioned Shakespeare and you say, you know, Julius Caesar was, you know.
Yeah.
Because I said the same thing to Danny Boyle. I interviewed Danny Boyle a couple of weeks ago. And I said, I imagine the family of Richard III wasn't too happy about that portrayal either. But at least Shakespeare had the good sense not to write about people who were recently alive and many of whose friends are still alive. That's always a risky thing to do.
Yeah. Right? History is moving too quickly. So I can understand the inherent like pushback against doing Steve Jobs biopic like this.
I would have enjoyed it as a Romanza Clef if they had kind of thinly veiled it as, you know, Steve Jobsky or something.
Steve Mobs. Yeah.
Steve Mobs. I wouldn't have minded it that much, but gosh, you know, and you, I'm sure you also, Devinder. I mean, we know a lot of these people, and I feel bad for them.
Yeah, I mean, I think what was most interesting is that, Lisa Brennan Jobs actually, you know, helped out. She talked with Aaron Sorkin. This movie has her perspective, whereas, you know, I've read all the Steve Jobs biographies so far, and she, you know, has refused to talk to anybody, including Walter Isaacson, who's made probably, you know, that's the Apple-approved, the Steve Jobs-approved biography, and she didn't even talk to him. I think it's the film has other things to say.
Yeah, it's interesting. And I have to admit that that is probably the most reprehensible story and anecdote in Steve Jobs' life is how he denied his daughter for so long. Mm-hmm.
That the movie doesn't show that he was living with Steve.
Married,
she was living with Steve Jobs.
I know, and I have mentioned this before. In '94, I spent a long weekend with Steve, Lorene, Reed had just been born, and Lisa, and they were a loving family. And this is, of course, you know, it's very different from the portrayal in the movie. On the other hand, Jobs is so venerated; very few people ever bring this. You know, really want to talk about this issue, and it is pretty reprehensible. So.
I don't know that that's the case. I think a lot of people, well, maybe not in the
general public,
general media.
Much, yeah,
exactly. But I feel like everyone.
We all know it, but we don't want to talk about it. You know, we want to talk about his successes and, you know, how he was tough, but fair or whatever it is. It's all, you know what? It's all mythos. Yeah. It's all made up. The human being is far too complex, especially a genius like Jobs, far too complex to portray in a movie. Or a book or anything, I think. I don't feel like I'm any closer to understanding Steve than I ever was, frankly. Let's take a break. How about that? Just trying to manage our time. I have so much to talk about today. I want to talk about the FBI paying $1 million to Carnegie Mellon to break Tor for months. Months. Talk about a overreach. But first, let's talk about my mattress, because that's much more peaceful and restful and nice, and I have a very nice mattress. His name is Casper. Casper the Friendly Mattress. Actually, Casper is a site, Casper, CASPER.com, where you can go and get American-made mattresses, premium mattresses, for a fraction of the price you'd pay if you went to a mattress store, and that's because They eliminate the middleman. The mattress store markup is massive. You can do better. Casper's mattress is obsessively engineered. They use latex and memory foam to give you a great support. See, I like a firm mattress, but they give too, because Lisa likes it to give a little bit. We both love our Casper mattress, and I think you will love yours too. Now, the challenge, of course, is how do you sell direct from Casper? Because people want to try before they buy. You know, we're all used to going to the mattress store and lying uncomfortably on a mattress with our shoes on and the sales girl giving us the stink eye, trying to imagine what it'd be like to sleep on this every night for the rest of our lives. It's not a good system at all. The way the Casper works, you order it. It comes in a box, a surprisingly compact box. You open it up. Oh, so comfortable. Now you have 100 nights to decide. This is the trial period. 100 nights. If any time in those first 100 nights you say, yeah, it's not for me, they'll come and get it and refund you every penny. So you can try before you buy. For 100 nights, really the best way to do it. Lying in a bed in a showroom has no correlation to how you're going to like that mattress. I was talking to my son, Henry. We sent him a Casper when he was last year. I guess he was a sophomore in college. And he lived on the third floor, and it came in a nice compact box. He could get up there. He loved it. He moved it to his new apartment, and I said, "You're going to take it with you because he's moving again." He said, "Yeah, it's seen a little action. I think I might get a new one," and I think that's probably a good idea. And the nice thing about Casper is it's easy, it's affordable. $500 for a twin, $950 for the king size. I mean, just compare that, even to the best sales at the mattress store down the street. And you're going to save an additional $50 just by using the promo code TWIT, casper.com/TWIT. We're learning more and more that a good night's sleep impacts everything, including your health, your well-being. Get a better night's sleep. Better sleep for brighter days at casper.com/TWIT. Don't forget the promo code TWIT. How you feeling, Jeff? You getting a little woozy, a little tired?
I'm doing all right.
All right. Patrick, you're okay?
I was in Finland.
What were you doing in Helsinki?
Another sad event. It was a death in my wife's family.
I'm sorry.
Grandmother, long and happy life. It was okay.
Is your wife Finnish? Yeah.
Yes, absolutely.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. She's a Swedish-speaking Finn. So they actually have a Swedish-speaking minority, and Finland has two official languages. So, yeah, and I arrived the day after the Slush Festival, which has become a very big tech event in Finland. It's one of the biggest, if not the biggest, in the Nordic region. And they call it Slush. They have a lot of, you know, because of the snow and the lovely weather out there.
It's really appealing. I can't wait to go to the Slush. Slush 2015 at slush.org. Wow.
Yeah.
I guess if you live in Slush, you got to celebrate the Slush.
Exactly. It's becoming a thing.
Look who they had. Wow.
Yeah.
What a great panel. Were you going to go? Were you invited to that, Mr. Jarvis? Seems like this.
No. I saw Katarina before. Katarina lives half the time in Finland now.
She does. Oh.
Yeah, she's learning Finnish.
That's an interesting pursuit. It's a difficult language. It's kind of a Turkish language.
There's nothing to grab onto.
Nothing at all. And only like 4 or 5 million people speak it. So why not? Why not? The nice thing about Finland and Sweden, everybody speaks perfect English.
Yes.
It's kind of remarkable. It makes me feel like a slacker, to be honest. Maybe that's why Katarina is learning Finnish. No one can call you a slacker if you learn Finnish. So, Carnegie Mellon. This is crazy, crazy. I'm going to try to get this right. Correct me if I got the details or the facts wrong. According to the Tor project, the FBI wanted to uncloak users of the Tor network, an anonymizing network we've talked about often, the Onion router, used by the Silk Road. Apparently, that was one of the people they wanted to catch, was one of the people involved with the new Silk Road. They were also going after a child pornographer. Nothing wrong with that.
So they went to Carnegie Mellon researchers to crack Tor's anonymizing network. And according to the Tor project, paid CMU $1 million. So they, I guess they wanted to know how to do it. The FBI wanted to know how to do it. So they paid CMU $1 million. Of course, the issue is, yeah, this is great. They caught the bad guys. But during the period in which Tor was de-anonymized, many thousands of people used it, and their privacy was non-existent. There was no warrant, or there's no indication that there was a warrant. According to the Tor project, there was no oversight, institutional oversight by Carnegie Mellon's Institutional Review Board. They were paid by the FBI to attack hidden services, then sift through the data to find people they could accuse of crimes. So that's another issue, which I'm not sure about, but the other issue would be, was it a fishing expedition? Hey, just see what you can find in there. Or were they actually going after this Brian Richard Farrell?
What's changed since? Is this an exploit that's still possible?
Ah, that's a good question. That's a good question. I don't get the impression that it's ongoing. The Tor project noticed in July a group of malicious relays, that's the best way to crack Tor, were trying to pick out people who were looking for hidden services, sites hosted on Tor, like Facebook.onion. They used a mix of nodes and exit relays, along with some vulnerabilities in the network protocol that allowed for users' real IP addresses to be discovered. Those relays were subsequently removed by the Tor project.
Oh, okay.
But how is this different from the FBI or anyone else exploiting a flaw in a protocol to peek into a secure network?
Huge difference. Because if the FBI is going after somebody and trying to gather evidence and does, in fact, as we know, this does happen, use exploit zero-day flaws and stuff to go after that person, they're presumably, A, doing that with a warrant. It's a kind of wiretapping. And, B, it's targeted. This is more like a fishing expedition. This net caught anybody who used those relays. And it was run for a period of, I think, 4 or 5 months.
I feel like this is the typical fallout of government surveillance in general. Yeah. You're always going to have people, well, the government's always going to say that innocent bystanders are going to be a byproduct of what they're trying to do.
Collateral damage.
Right.
Matthew Green, who's a really great cryptographer, one of the really the thought leaders in this field, he's a professor at Johns Hopkins, wrote an article about why the Tor attack matters on Wednesday. And that's the point he makes, is the collateral damage. I mean, nobody's going to argue that you shouldn't go after somebody possessing child pornography or staff members at Silk Road 2.0. He says there's no reason to believe the defendants were the only people affected. If the details of the attack are as we understand them, a group of academic researchers deliberately took control of a significant portion of the Tor network without oversight. This attack ran for 5 months, potentially de-anonymized thousands of users who depend on Tor to protect them from serious harm.
And they took money for it.
And they took $1 million for it. Mm-hmm. This is similar to RSA taking money from the NSA, or was it the NSA paid NIST? Who was it to recommend a broken protocol? that's a story. This is an old story, but that's a story. NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Time, is that it? And the NSA were in cahoots to promote a weak crypto standard, hoping that bad guys would use it.
It's
go ahead.
I was going to refer to something you said in passing at the beginning of the show. You mentioned The Wire, the TV show. And I think it can put a little bit of focus on something that seems like a completely foreign subject or right to us now. You know, go watch The Wire again, and you'll see how difficult it is for police
right.
forces.
It's always been difficult. It should be.
Yeah, and that's what I don't understand. When did we go? Was it 9/11? I don't know. When did, yes. did it go from?
Yes.
It has to be difficult for the police, because it's not like in The Wire. I know it's a work of fiction, but it used elements of reality. It's not like, you know, the people they were spying on were evading tax. They were actually selling drugs that were killing kids. You know, it wasn't, and it probably, I'm going to say something a little bit controversial, but I think factually it's probably true. They were probably making more damage to American society than
the terrorists, you
know, terrorists yes. actually did. If you count Absolutely. Cold in a cold manner, the number of yeah. dead. So how did it work that we actually went from, it has to be somewhat difficult. You have to have protections for people and make that job reasonably difficult. You have to have a warrant to, we can pay, you know, we can inject bad certificates, or we can pay a Carnegie Mellon to de-anonymize the Tor network. I don't understand how we jumped that shark.
This is
as a society.
It felt exactly like that feeling you had, Patrick, right? That, okay, maybe let the government surveil everything, right? Because maybe that would help prevent another attack. Right. And yeah, after 9/11, I was in college when that happened. And my college experience was basically colored by our response to 9/11. And it's crazy to see how this entire country went from, you know, a place where police had to go through a lot of legwork to get surveillance done, to where it was basically like our first response was to just like do whatever it takes to catch people. And I'm worried now, like especially after the Paris attacks, that we're going to see something similar happening.
Jeff Jarvis, if anyone would have standing to say, hey, go get those bad guys, it's you. I mean, you came very narrowly close to being killed in 9/11 yourself. And I know that you know people who were, and you, in fact, have suffered health problems that might be attributed to 9/11. Do you feel like never again, whatever it takes, let's go get those guys?
No, I confess I did go through a bit of that afterwards. I mean, I went from being a pacifist to a hawk. But we have to have standards of a democratic society. And we have to stand by those. And we can't be run by just the exceptions. And you know, being able to keep secrets is and have privacy and to encrypt is part of what we need to be able to have in an open and free society. If you cannot presume that something is secure, then nothing is secure. So we need that as a society. And then we have a system of warrants that enables the government to go after the bad guys. When the New York Times first started working on the warrantless wiretaps that Snowden ended up revealing so much, I thought wrongly at first, well, this is just to get the base data to see the exceptions. But no, it was tapping into our very internet. It was tapping into the core. It was lying to us about what was happening. We have no faith in our own government right now. Whenever I go speak abroad, I joke about apologizing for the NSA. These days now I apologize for Donald Trump, but that's another story.
It has a negative effect too on our own security. When the NSA co-opted the RSA with a $10 million payment to promote a weakened crypto standard, that crypto standard is still in our browsers and still to this day, years later, is a weakness mm-hmm. that companies like Microsoft and Google have been trying very hard to banish from the browsers. That's there because the RSA took $10 million from the NSA to put it in there.
A moral hazard if there ever was one.
Yeah, no kidding. Now,
but
here's one that's
totally fine.
Here's one that's a little harder to justify, but I think we can make a strong case. According to The Intercept, 70 million prisoners' phone calls have been tapped. An anonymous hacker believes that Securus is violating constitutional rights of inmates, has released information that says 70 million phone calls placed by prisoners in 37 states. Now, you might say, well, they're prisoners. Screw them. But many of those phone calls were to their attorneys.
That's the key.
Constitutionally protected.
I don't know whether they have a right, phone calls in general, but phone calls to attorneys are privileged, period. Full stop.
Yeah. And this is, by the way, another whistleblower who said, hey, this is not right. I'm going to talk about this.
So. It's it feels there are so many things that don't feel right. You know, ever since we've started to have serious problems with all of these consequences of the terrorist attacks, I've been thinking a lot about Master Yoda, of all people. You know what he says? He says a bunch of things which conclude with I think, fear leads to the dark side. And it's a pop culture reference, which, as with many pop culture references, though, have a lot of truth, right? It's these terrorists cannot defeat us militarily. It just, they can't. They don't have the resources. They cannot kill enough of us to make an impact. They can, what they can do is make us afraid so that we will change who we are. And that's exactly what the venerable and fictional Master Yoda was saying. Fear leads to the dark side. And I think that's what we're seeing. We're afraid, so we're making decisions that is making us, you know, changing who we are, and I think not for the better.
And you've been seeing that happen constantly since 9/11. And people are so quick to just want to say that surveillance should be the end all because, you know, that's how we protect ourselves. But you do have to have some kind of standards there. And after what happened in Paris, it's, I'm sure a lot of people are going to, you know, come back on that a little bit. But like you said, it's important to remember that that terrorism instills fear. Terror, that's what it is.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Remember that when the knee jerk happens, because it's about to. Well, yeah.
I'm always interested in how pop culture responds to like real world events in the, you know, the state of the culture right now. And it's funny how surveillance is like one of the prevailing plot points in movies, in TV shows these days, and not just like, you know, things related to spying. Even the latest, like, James Bond is all about the whole global surveillance network and how that could be used badly. And it's almost to the point where we're getting sick of it, where it feels like all these movies are just recycling the same idea. But it also feels like as a culture, we have something to work through because, like, we're feeling this and, you know, we don't know what's going on with this, all the surveillance around us.
I thought Spectre was interesting getting on James Bond because
it's a terrible movie. But, yeah.
I know that people think it's a terrible movie.
Wait a minute. You liked the Steve Jobs movie, but you hated the James Bond movie?
Spectre. Spectre was so bad because I loved Skyfall and Spectre was so boring.
I hated Skyfall.
Go ahead.
But it got good reviews in Britain. It was a good portrayal, though, of how government surveillance gone bad. And they, you know, they had people at the highest levels of government trying to spy on people for the greater good. And it just showed, you know, maybe in not the best way, but it made its point that that's not a necessarily good thing always.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So should I see it?
Spectre?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You should see it. It's very pretty, but
I've seen every James Bond movie. I guess I should go see that one.
It feels like, you know, so I'm a big Daniel Craig fan as James Bond.
Me too. Me too.
It feels like they've gone all the way back to like Pierce Brosnan, not so great Bond, because all the camp is back. None of the like great tension or like psychological drama that Daniel Craig's movies have had, except for Quantum Solace. But
it's funny, the British papers loved it, but the Americans hated it.
Yes.
Why do you think that is?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's 2.5 hours of entertainment. That's what you have to understand.
I'm told that the opening sequence, you know, all James Bond movies before the credits begin with a chase scene or something.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm told that that's a really good one.
Yeah.
I thought it was good.
Yeah.
I have a lot of feelings on that, but yeah, it's pretty.
Devendra, come on, let it out.
It's a helicopter fight that's boring. How do you make a James Bond helicopter fight?
You were actually bored, huh? Wow.
Yeah.
I can't believe you thought that was boring.
I don't know, Devendra. You like the Steve Jobs movie. Seat.
I like good action movies. That one felt like it was a helicopter fight that felt like it went on for maybe a minute or 2 minutes too long. There's a great chase, or there's a chase scene in that movie where they're driving supercars on the, you know, the streets of Rome or something. And even that's like very slow and very boring.
So I'm always bored by car chases.
You can do car chases badly.
They feel so obligatory.
Yeah.
The only good one that I remember at all was the one where they had all the Mini Coopers. Mm-hmm. Was it the Italian Job?
The Italian Job remake, yeah.
That was comic.
The Bourne Supremacy's car chase, the one with the taxi and
the motorcycle.
Well, there is the taxi versus the SUV, but yeah, that's a whole
I don't remember
thing.
That one.
Listen to my film podcast for that.
Oh, that's right. No wonder we're talking about this. You do a film podcast.
That's what I do. Yeah, slashfilm.com.
That's what you do?
As a side.
Are you giving up in Gadget? Oh, okay.
Right. I have my fingers in many pies, yeah.
Well, what Jennifer does is cover finance at MarketWatch and tech. You're the tech reporter, but I imagine you have some thoughts about this. Mark Andreessen, who was, I didn't know this, but an early investor in Facebook, is selling 70% of his stock. What's up?
Yeah, he sold it over the last 2 weeks. I don't know. He's been unloading his shares. You know, no one could say why he's doing it. Facebook's up 30% this year. So maybe it's a little bit of profit taking, but
you don't think it's a lack of confidence in Facebook?
People are going to say it's a lack of confidence. And either way, if you're pulling that much of your money out of Facebook, and you're an early investor, and he sits on the board also, I believe, then yeah, that's going to raise some eyebrows. But it's also Facebook hasn't really shown many indications of trouble ahead. So it's, you know, it's an interesting situation. And you could say some of it is profit taking, but it does, for a lot of people, kind of raise some questions as to why he would be doing that right now.
How much? He's also got to return money to investors, right? He's got a fund, and so
was it fund stock or was it his personal stock?
Oh, I don't know which it was, but in any case, he reinvests. So to me, the more interesting question is, where will Mark Andreessen put $160 million next? That's what's far more interesting. I mean, he did well in it, and at some point, you turn the money around.
Yeah,
and that's what he's doing.
Yeah, the stock is doing better now than anyone could have possibly. I wrote a story earlier this week about how, you know, all of the haters now are talking about how great Facebook is, because remember when it went public, it had that botched IPO and people were really kind of questioning. There were some analysts that were saying, oh, we don't know about this stock. And here we are 2 years later and it's doing so well. It's hitting all time highs. It's one of the most valuable companies in the US, right up there, not too far behind Google and Apple. So I think, you know, why not go out when you're on top and, reinvest that money in somewhere else that may need it.
Yeah, I know Facebook's doing well. I don't allow myself to buy tech stocks, but my wife does, and she's continually rubbing it in my face how well her Facebook stock is doing.
I don't know. Maybe Mark Andreessen's just going to reinvest in Twitter or something, because, boy, is he a great Twitterer. So,
he loves those tweet storms.
Yeah.
He loves Twitter. Yeah. Twitter and Periscope is all over it.
I don't understand tweet storms. I think surely you could write a Medium post. It seems like such a bad
way. It's not the same.
Yeah.
I think Twitter is very different, and I think they're going to be doing something to allow these kinds of posts to exist on Twitter. I think they need to.
Mm-hmm. I keep Andreessen as a column on TweetDeck.
Oh, how funny.
Yeah. It's the only way to keep up with him.
I was at the Foursquare conference, not that Foursquare, but the other Foursquare conference in New York, which is off the record. But a certain entrepreneur asked how he keeps up on things. He said, I just watch Mark Andreessen's Twitter feed. That's how I keep up on everything.
You don't think that the constraint of 140 characters lends itself to misunderstanding and
oh, for sure.
You know, sure, misstatements. But what does
that's why they tweet storm. That's why they tweet storm.
It's intentionally cryptic. Right?
I think it's been around long enough where you understand how to navigate the word limit. And yeah, then you have people doing the multiple tweets in a row to tell a story. But I think a lot of people actually are pretty good at being concise nowadays.
Well, he numbers them, doesn't he?
Yeah.
When he has his tweet storms, he'll have number one, number two, up to maybe 15.
Write a blog post. I don't get it. I think
it is sort of a way to call people to attention, because then you're getting immediate feedback to every, you know, the next tweet in your series or something. What's interesting about Andreessen is that he doesn't just like shout to the void. Like, he is interacting with people. He replies to people, and not just, you know, starred, you know, popular people on Twitter or something.
Well, but that's okay. So that's exactly what Twitter's for and good for. Mm-hmm. It seems to me, writing a long screed on Twitter, numbered tweets, is crazy. Crazy. And now I search for tweet storms and I'm finding articles on how to create and deliver tweet storms the easy way. Like a vault. Not what we want.
No, but I think, you know, it speaks to the specificity of the ecosystem of Twitter. I think there hasn't been a social network that is about immediate interaction in the way that Twitter is. Obviously, Google Plus is not as successful as Google would have wanted it to be. And Facebook has sort of returned a little bit to their more, you know, intimate chat with your circle of people origins after having tried to make everyone public and, you know, sharing things publicly to sort of and chase Twitter. But it didn't really work out. And now Twitter is left alone in that sphere of very public interaction with with people you don't actually know. And there's nothing else that does that.
Dave Weiner has apparently, I didn't realize this, written an app. Oh, I'm not authorized to use it. What the hell? Leo Laporte is not authorized to use
this
app.
What did you do?
Dave, he's written an app called Little Pork Chop that you designed for making tweet storms. But apparently I'm on the do not tweet list. That is weird. Dave.
You'd probably break it if you tried to use it, Leo.
Why do you think, who is it?
Too many followers.
Yeah, who's, maybe that's it. Maybe that's it. Maybe there's a limit to the number of followers you can have.
Yeah. But the thing about like tweet storming versus like writing a blog post or something, you know, you could do it from anywhere. Like, I don't know how Andreessen tweets so much and where he does it, but you can tweet anywhere. You can tweet on the toilet.
In the can, of course. That's exactly it. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Update, not Patrick is not authorized to use the app either. So it's not just you, Leo.
Well, who is? I wonder what's going on there. So, all right, here it is. This is ridiculous. The world's largest iPad. We'll talk about it. And Tim Cook's desire to basically get you all to stop using computers and start using iPads. Please. The end of the PC era or just ridiculous? I ask you. But first, a word from Carbonite. You never know when disaster will strike at work or at home. I had a call on the radio show today. A guy was in his house, but he had a visitor who left and didn't close the door behind him. So a homeless couple came in and stole his laptop. He didn't even see him do it. But I guess he found out later. A homeless couple. And he said, hey, can they do anything with my laptop? And I said, well, I just hope you have it backed up with Carbonite. See, weird stuff happens. Hard drives die, fires, flood, homeless people steal your stuff. And then, especially if you're in business, you might be out of business. If your accounts receivable and your client list and your suppliers lists are all there on your hard drives and you lose that data, but it'd be hard to get that back. Now, you may be saying, well, that's not a problem. I have Joe in accounting go down every week with a external hard drive. He backs the whole thing up. We put it in a closet. Yeah, see, that's not it. What if there's a fire? Then you lose everything, including the backup in the closet. Carbonite's great because it takes your data all the time. Whenever you're online, it's continuously backing it up to the cloud. Encrypted channel, encrypted at rest. It's there. It's in the Carbonite data center, air-conditioned. Your data's relaxing. It's enjoying a vacation. But the minute you need it, boom, you get it back. You can log on to your Carbonite account on any computer. They have free apps for the iOS and Android. You get your stuff. You can see if it's there. You can even email it to somebody else. Prepare for the unexpected. Protect your data with secure, automatic, that's really important, cloud backup from Carbonite. No wonder 1.5 million homes and small businesses trust Carbonite to back up their computers and their servers and keep them in business. You just, it's like fire insurance. You can't buy it after you have a fire. You got to do it now. While you're listening to the show, go to Carbonite.com. Use the offer code TWIT. You'll get 2 free bonus months. And right now they have some very good deals, up to 30% off. Carbonite.com. Use the offer code TWIT. Did any of you get an iPad Pro? Did you rush to the store?
No.
I'm waiting to buy the Pixel C.
Yeah.
I want the Pixel C. But I got the iPad Pro because I, you know, they put it on, Apple put it on sale Wednesday, and they said, you know, you could pick it up at the store. I said, oh, I'll take
it. Nobody else is running to get it in line for it.
Apparently there's not, there wasn't a long line. This thing is mad. It's like a tea tray. You could actually serve drinks on it.
Deal with the butler.
And then the weird thing is Apple's Pencil was not available till next month. So it seems the whole thing about the iPad Pro, which is drawing on it, is kind of something we're just going to have ridiculous. To wait for. I know. That seems very odd.
Yeah, I feel like you need the keyboard and the Apple Pencil for right. it to be a whole package.
Well, I got – okay, so I bought – call me crazy. But I bought – this is a keyboard and cover. Apple was selling this at the store from Logitech. It's called the Create. Apple's own keyboard is $170. And it doesn't have any dedicated iPad keys. This keyboard case was $20 cheaper, and it has a home key, a search key.
It's then it's a bargain, Leo.
It's a bargain at only $150. And they
the keys also look a lot better too. Yeah.
Well, but you know what? When look at this, this thing is it's heavier than a MacBook, like a lot thicker than a MacBook. I don't know why you would use this instead of any laptop. Frankly, I mean, I guess because of the touch, right? And Apple steadfastly refuses to put touch on its OS X stuff. So, but that's the big difference. You got touch and you got a fingerprint reader, which is
what's the battery life like?
Oh, it's basically permanent. It's a forever battery life. It's the thing is so huge. But now, Devendra, I think Gadget said that despite Apple calling the A9X, the processor in here, a desktop class, you guys said it's not.
Yeah, as far as I can tell. I actually haven't read that piece yet.
It's
from our UK folks.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but it's just from what we've seen and what I've been reading, you know, all around the web, it's nothing too special. And there are some benchmarks that have been comparing it to things like current Intel chips or something.
Right.
But they're not like Apple. It's sort of like an apples and oranges comparison because they're comparing you know, mobile code versus desktop code. And it's very different.
Yeah. I mean, this is an ARM processor. Mm-hmm. Apple, it's very aspirational for them to say, oh, that's the post-PC future, and now you can who needs a PC because you've got this. I like touch. I really like my Surface Book because I can use a pen, I can touch, but I can also use it as a real laptop. It's a great, I have to say, and Patrick, you'll appreciate this, it's a great gaming platform, except that so far nobody's designed games to take advantage of the real estate, so all you get is a blown up game. But I think, you know, for Goat Simulator, this is awesome.
Well, that makes it worth it.
Yeah, it's definitely a goat. I think
throw away your laptop for this.
Yeah. Yeah,
great gaming platform. You're playing a little bit fast and loose with that term there, Leo.
Well, it's a pretty screen, you can't deny that. Touch is nice. Yeah, no, it's great. I mean, you want to play Clash of Clans? Come on. Now we're talking.
I thought we were talking about actual games. I'm sorry, I must have misunderstood.
I did this. I got in trouble for saying Clash of Clans wasn't a real game.
No, I know. It's actually a pretty fun game. I've played it for a few months.
You don't work at Blizzard anymore, do you? Did you leave?
Yeah, I actually left about a year ago to become a podcaster.
Oh, a year ago. Okay, never mind.
Yeah.
But Patrick comes from a gaming background, so that's all. Yes. I bring it up for that reason.
Yeah, of course. I've worked at Blizzard for 5 years, and I'm a big gaming fan.
The sound is good, though. It's got four speakers. It's very nice, rich sound. I can't really see. This was $1,000 minus the keyboard.
Yeesh.
It's, you know, I think a lot of people in our circles are looking at this and sort of bewildered by basically the target for it,
right.
Including me. Honestly, I'm not sure who it is for, but I think you were talking about aspirations. I think these devices, and that includes the Pixel C, are very different from the Surface Pro because they're trying to bring the strengths of a mobile OS, of iOS, to a more work-like environment. And the strengths are simplicity and ease of use and things that aren't as obvious for, that don't really exist as much in a desktop OS. And that's why I don't think they will ever merge iOS and Mac OS. These are two different approaches. The game is to try and make iOS capable enough that it will be able to accomplish a lot of work tasks without making it as complex as a classic desktop OS. And that's the ultimate goal. If they manage to do it, I think there might be a lot of people who are interested in getting an iOS device, a big iPad Pro, for example, so they don't have to worry about managing a full desktop OS. I'm not sure the current iPad Pro and iOS 9 are quite there yet, though.
Mm-hmm. this feels almost like a prototype of an idea, right? Like the, the iPhone 6C. Let's like get another iPhone out there that's plastic and maybe a little cheaper to make and maybe market it to some folks and see if anybody bites. Nobody really bid on that. This feels similar in a way. But yeah, the idea of tablets ultimately becoming more productive, which, by the way, is something Microsoft has been touting for a long time. I actually really like the new Surface Pro 4 and the Surface Book.
I love my Surface Book.
It's so good.
It makes me feel like I wish Apple would just do a MacBook with touch, because I think that's perfect.
Yeah. But I think this is Apple's so far down. You know, they're just in too deep, right? iOS has been all their touch innovation. OS X, honestly, as great as it is, I use it on my work computer. It still looks basically the same as it did when it came out in 2001. Like they're like really dedicated to this desktop interface. I'm wondering if like we'll even ever see another full-fledged desktop OS that doesn't look like anything from OS X from Apple, or is the goal to like just push iOS to eventually be that thing and keep this OS X design as like their main desktop interface going forward?
I think, you know, imagine if iOS was pushed enough, as I was saying, that it could do everything you need. Because I'm guessing, Leo, you can't do everything you need.
It's an iPad. There's no file system. There's no, I mean, you know.
Well, I mean, with the cloud, there is kind of a simile. It's better now than iCloud was, 3 years ago. But
imagine you see the split. I'm doing the split screen. So it has a very primitive form of windowing, tiling,
If it could do everything you could with the while retaining a lot of the simplicity of iOS, couldn't you imagine using this rather than a full-fledged desktop OS, which is complicated to manage and to update and to
For my mom, I shouldn't say that's sexist. For my dad, for people whose needs are few.
Now it's ageist.
Now it's ageist. For my 4-year-old, I don't know.
Still ages, but yeah.
Either way, though, it's not there yet.
It's not there yet.
Yeah.
So Jennifer, you don't look at this and go, "Oh, gotta get one."
No, not yet. Well, I think part of the, I believe you can't have more than one of the same app open. So that, I feel like that could be annoying. And also, I will say though that Joanna Stern reviewed it, and she said she was able to export video faster on the Pro than she was on her MacBook. But for the most part, though, I still think you're more efficient. At least I feel like I would be more efficient having a full laptop rather than how that's set up with the mobile operating system.
Yeah. See, so I have Word open over here, and I now can't go back to Word over here. So I think you're right. You can only have one instance of any program. This is
I'm sure they'll work on that.
But Jeff, I feel like there's a certain masochistic thing where I see people like Christina Warren and Joanna saying, "I'm going to use this as my only computer for a while." And yeah, of course you could do that. But it's a little masochistic. It's like, yeah, but it's going to be a little bit of a struggle. Why not just use a laptop? But you're doing that with a Chromebook, Jeff, and you're very happy.
That's a real laptop, and it has a real file structure, and I can get to documents, and I can use it offline, and I can open multiple things in it, and it's just, the browser works well. I'm going to try the Pixel C, but I'm kind of dreading that. I finally, I didn't want to take my new Pixel 6P to Africa with me in case I, dropped it in the water.
The Nexus, yeah.
Nexus,
yeah.
I'm sorry. So I just got it going this weekend, and then trying to find where the heck the screenshot goes and this and that. It's a pain on mobile app OS.
It is. It's so much a desktop. I don't think, while I've said many times we are in a post-PC era, I want to revise that. Not everybody, not all of us are. I really like having a computer.
Yeah. We're in a transition phase right now, and all these companies are trying to figure it out. But yeah, I guess it'll be interesting to see. I really like the Surface Pro 4. Like, I liked the Surface Pro 3, but I had some issues. Yeah. Pro 4 is just like, it's incredible, like, what Microsoft packed into something that's under £2. I only hope, like, eventually they can figure out the pricing and get the keyboard in that Surface pricing. Because right now, it's still kind of, it feels like a ripoff in a way.
I love Woz, Steve Wozniak, who never wants to say anything bad about anybody or anything. they asked him at the New Relic conference what he thinks of the iPad Pro, and He just said, well, I'm more of a laptop-based guy.
But, you know, I think that's the case for all of us. And you said, I love my computer. I love my Surface Book.
Yeah.
We do. I would never give up my PC for anything in the world. Most people hate computers.
Right.
They're foreign. They don't know how to use them. They're confused when there's an update that comes up, and then Windows gets updated to Windows 10 when they didn't ask it to do that. And, you know, it's very complicated to use, but they love their phone because it's simple. They don't have to worry about it.
And having just come from time in two countries in Africa and two in Latin America, it just really, really hits you how much mobile is it. And they suffer because it's 3G and it's slow. You look at things like Google Lamp and Instant Articles and it speeds things up. But the phone is that future. If you go to Google, I mean, the last 2 years at Google, I tried to complain about things that weren't in the web. And they said, web, why do we bother with that? The future is mobile. And I think perhaps we in the U.S. are just kind of hanging on to an anachronistic past of the PC.
I also think it depends what you use it for, because I mean, if you do a lot of work on your PC, and I mean, I do a lot of writing, obviously, and research, and I like to have multiple things open, even multiple screens if possible. And that's just easier on a desktop right now. And I definitely understand the need to have a mobile experience. And you know, even when I go to events, I bring my laptop, but it can be cumbersome and just takes longer to boot. And there's various, or eats battery. But right now, you're right. Maybe I am holding on to it, but I do find it more efficient still.
So. Mm-hmm.
It's great for playing Fallout Shelter.
Fallout Shelter, yeah, that screen really makes it shine. But you know, one great Steve said a while ago, he sees them as, you know, the PCs as trucks. They're not going away, and I don't know, you know, if it's going to happen. I'm joking, obviously, but that's, I think, what we're kind of saying here. We all of us here, and people who actually need those more heavy duty devices are going to stay on full desktop OSs, but maybe not everyone needs them.
Mm-hmm. There are some specialized uses. Lisa wants to use this as a second screen, which an iPad does quite well on a Macintosh. And it's fine. This is big enough. You actually would make sense as a second screen. 12.9 inches. It's a good screen. I mean, I just also feel like, though, Apple didn't do a whole lot to accommodate this larger screen. These icons, look how spaced out they are. It's just a blown up user interface that not really taking great advantage of it. So
yeah, it feels really rushed, honestly. Like Apple didn't sit down and, you know, make the software changes that would really make a device like this shine. Speaking of like this whole crossover between desktop and mobile, I'm really interested in seeing how Microsoft's Windows 10 phones handle that continuum feature, which lets you, you know, plug in the phone into a monitor and use that as a full desktop. That could be a big thing because, single phone could be a lot more useful to people than, you know, a giant freaking tablet.
I disagree with you, though, Devendra, that Apple rushed the interface. I think everything that we've seen in split view and slide over and all of this was done for this device. It's been integrated in the previous devices, so we sort of know them already, but I think everything was done for this. And the apps being blown out and not making use of the real estate, that's exactly how I felt about the first iPad, and I kind of got used to it. I thought the icon, you know, the icons for the apps were very small. I think we'll get used to that. The simplicity in this case might be a feature that is willfully designed. It might evolve as well, but
I don't see this thing selling well by any count.
No, me neither, to be honest.
I think I just sold it to a bunch of Clash of Clans users.
But see, you're over here playing games, and I don't think that a lot of gamers are going to go out of their way to spend all this money on the Pro. I feel like Apple at least was thinking that it would be, you know, for more, you know, the creative people who will take advantage of the stylus or, you know, other maybe people in the enterprise or whatever. But I just wonder if gamers, the people playing those games are going to spring for the most expensive iPad on the market just for games.
Mm-hmm.
I am. I'm sorry. I should stop because I'm not paying any attention at all.
Yeah. For half the price, you can get the other, you know, the normal full-sized iPad with a keyboard thing. And, you know, I tried them both side by side, and it doesn't feel like a big enough difference on the gaming front.
No force touch.
We'll see things optimized.
And do you think it's a gaffe, a blunder, that they didn't have the pencil ready at the same time as they had the tablet ready?
Yeah.
That's surprising to me. Because that
it's the first time, I think, that we've seen Tim Cook, which is a wizard at supply chain, sort of not manage to get things out at the same time.
Yeah.
I don't think it's ever happened before. But, you know, it's a few weeks
away. I wonder, you got to wonder if something happened, something went wrong, and they said, oh, crap, the head, you know, the top falls off or something, and we got to go back to the drawing board.
Yeah, because you would have thought they would have made an amount enough to match up with how many iPads they thought they were going to sell.
Yeah. It's weird.
And the difference between this one and, which is great, a big deal in productivity, between this one and the iPad Air 2, which is the only other one that can do the split view currently, so two apps side by side, is that the screen real estate isn't big enough for the iPad Air 2 to have iPad mode apps side by side. What I mean by iPad mode is that, for example, on the, let's take the example of the mail app, you'll have the list of emails and in a column on the left, and then your email that you have selected to read on the right of that screen. And if you switch that to side-by-side mode, if you do half and half, you're going to be in iPhone mode, which means you can either have the list of emails or the email you have selected. And the iPad Pro can run two full iPad mode apps at the same time. So that, what it actually means is that on the iPad Air 2, you can't really use it for productivity. That split mode robs you of the big attractive feature of the the UI.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So if you want touch, get a Surface. Seriously, I like touch, but or get a Pixel, get a Chromebook Pixel. Jeff, did you say you're going to buy a Pixel C?
Yeah, but if it ever goes on sale, it's supposed to be ready before the end of the year.
Before Christmas, they said,
We're getting pretty tight here, folks.
Yeah. I'm wondering.
It's not cheap either.
Do we know what the price is?
Oh, yeah, they said, I think.
Do you know Jason Howell, our host of All About Android, is slumming with us?
Yeah, I don't know
the
price on that one.
Yeah.
Slumming with
us. I feel like the Pixel C is maybe the first look we're going to get at what could be Android meets Chrome OS. It's ostensibly an Android device, but it also, when you look at it, it looks a lot like a Surface or an iPad with the keyboard case.
The Pixel C, by the way, is $499 for the 30.
Oh, that's not bad. That's not expensive. Not bad.
But another $150 for the keyboard. So.
Oh, that's expensive.
It's the Microsoft.
Still, expensive.
Yeah.
Still cheaper than the other two, though.
Yeah.
Definitely.
But it's Android, and that's going to be the interesting thing, right?
But we're also seeing like
Surface.
Similar...
Isn't the Surface, the first price is $500, I think?
Yeah, I think this is now
for the plain, the lower end Surface. Not the Surface.
Right. I'm talking about the most recent.
Microsoft is not trying to make the Surface an particularly affordable, because I think they don't want to get in the way of their lower end OEMs, right? They're making a premium device. That's
I don't know. I've talked to a lot of Microsoft reps about, what is the deal with the Surface keyboard pricing? Because it seems, when you get to the point where the Surface Pro 4 is $899 and you have to spend another $130 for the keyboard, a student, somebody who's been saving up for the Surface might not realize that and feels a little disingenuous. What's interesting is that the Surface competitor is coming out from Lenovo, I think HP and Dell as well. Like, they're going to be including their keyboards at prices cheaper or the same as the Surface Pro. So Microsoft, that now again, it's getting a little weird.
Yeah, Microsoft's getting careful to, not step on their dance partner's toes too much.
Let's
keep it at arm's length. let's take a break. When we come back, I want to talk about what at first everybody was all excited that T-Mobile's offering free streaming, binging on video. And then T.C. Sotek, writing in The Verge, took all the wind out of my sails. T-Mobile, he writes, is writing the manual on how to F up the internet. Is it a net neutrality problem? We'll talk in just a sec. But first, a word from our friends at Citrix and Citrix GoToMeeting. It is so true nowadays that people are, businesses, companies are distributed all over the place. You know, we're doing app design with people in India and Canada. We're doing web design with people in Austin. And it's really important when you're doing that, that you're able to have these meetings. This is where you get together, resolve problems. You have a rule, no more than 3 emails back and forth. But then, if then you got to have a meeting, then you got to talk. It's a way to cut through the Gordian knot and get stuff done. It's also a great way to brainstorm, a great way to meet people. And then you might say, well, you can't meet people in GoToMeeting. Yes, you can. Because GoToMeeting not only shares screens, but it also shares video, high HD quality webcam video that makes it really feel like you're in the same room. It really is an experience of being together. And you can do it from any computer, tablet, smartphone, no travel, no traffic. You get things done, you're fast, you're efficient. GoToMeeting's awesome. And the nice thing is you can get it going before I'm done talking. Try it free for 30 days. Go to the website, GoToMeeting.com. Click the Try It Free button. Honestly, you could have your first meeting up and running in minutes. It's just that great. And by the way, not hard for your clients to use either. And that's important. You don't want to, if you're doing a sales presentation, you don't want to make your client jump through hoops. They get an invite in the email. They click that. The software downloads instantly. Boom. You're seeing them. They're seeing you. You're on the same page. They're seeing your PowerPoint. It's great. GoToMeeting. Try it free today. GoToMeeting.com. John Ledger, the CEO of T-Mobile, had another big event, their Uncarrier X event. Anybody go down to that? Was it in Los Angeles? I was invited, but I decided to pass. And actually, I guess I'm glad I did. This they announced Binge On. So T-Mobile for, and I'm a T-Mobile customer on one of my phones, on my Nexus. No, that's a Google Fi phone. On, now I don't remember. You know what's annoying? Google Fi uses T-Mobile, but you don't get the benefit of like this music stuff and the Binge On stuff. You do get the international travel benefit, right? So I like T-Mobile. My iPhone's on T-Mobile. Mm-hmm. And at first I thought, oh, this is great because, well, I've already been using, you know, when you listen to Spotify or Google Music or Apple Music on your iPhone, it doesn't count against your data cap, right? You don't have to pay for it. Now they're doing the same with Netflix, HBO Go, ESPN, Showtime, everybody but YouTube and us. And at first I thought, oh, that's great. But then I thought a little harder and I realized, isn't that basically Fastlane?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The scheme is called Zero Rating, and it really is a threat to the open internet. So this is hard because when you're a consumer, you go, yeah. But what you forget is that that favors, and it's making T-Mobile the judge and jury on this, favors certain incumbents over the other guys. Now, I think what we should do as an experiment is apply, say, as Twit, right? And say, we'd like to be part of Binge On.
Ah, yes.
Because that's how they're getting around it, right? By saying that any streaming can be on it? Is that how they're...
They say anybody can do it. If you follow their rules.
Anybody can. Yeah, exactly. If anybody can do it, then why don't they just do it for everyone from the get-go? From, you know,
then they wouldn't be able to send an unlimited data plan for $15 more a month now because of this.
So what are the rules?
I don't know. I guess we'll have to apply. One of the things I know they do is they downsample it to 720p. It's not 1080. So the file sizes are smaller.
It's not as high quality.
Yeah, but 720 is fine, right? Or no, I'm sorry. Yeah. It's not 720. It's DVD quality. It's 480.
Oh.
Ooh.
But it's your phone, so.
Yeah, maybe.
I'm, tablet,
do I have to pay him? I should really apply. Because if it is really neutral and anybody who streams can apply, I would want to be on that. That's the whole net neutrality issue, that T-Mobile gets to be the decider on, oh, Netflix, you're okay. Twit, no, you're not so okay. And if you're a T-Mobile customer, you're going to watch a lot more Netflix than you're going to watch Twit. It's the antithesis of net neutrality. All bits are not equal. But good luck convincing anybody of that.
So there's zero rating in some countries is necessary. You know, it's the whole Facebook's internet.org initiative, right? And I think in those cases, there is a heavy debate on whether or not zero rating is okay and if we can make an exception to net neutrality in those cases. I have a much harder time accepting it in the case of T-Mobile.
Well, and listen to one of our chatters. Little Bobby Salsa writes, the opposition to binge on just shows that net neutrality advocates don't actually care about consumers. They just like criticizing ISPs. And that's the problem. It's hard to explain to people who are getting free stuff why that's a bad thing.
It's very easy.
It's like a free speech argument almost, in the sense that you're defending something that doesn't sound right at the first, but is necessary as a principle.
Yeah.
And everything that's going on in universities right now is, well, that hurts our feelings. Well, okay, but debate is part of democracy. Well, how could you let everybody hurt our feelings? Well, because that's defending free speech, and it becomes a paradoxical argument.
Yeah.
And the same for this. It's a paradoxical argument to say that, yes, you may not get that Netflix movie for free, but you're defending a much higher principle.
Well, if you want the next Netflix.
Exactly.
You.
Yeah.
It's basically, if those kinds of rules had been put in place at a time when video wasn't common on the web, YouTube would just not have existed at all. And very likely, let's imagine a world where this is the norm. It's very likely that video streaming on the web would have been made incredibly more difficult. Mm-hmm. And we wouldn't have Netflix today, because as we've seen, the ISPs are brought into this level of consumption that the video streaming requires, kicking and screaming, not streaming, which would be more appropriate, kicking and screaming. And they have done, now it's sort of, you know, they've given up, kind of, but they really didn't want this to happen. They've been fighting Netflix and YouTube and everyone else to not upgrade their infrastructure or to make them pay for those upgrades. And I can guarantee you that that would have been almost impossible. And to those students, tell them, if you enjoy Netflix, it's probably because the open internet and some level of net neutrality has made it possible for an incumbent like Netflix to exist.
Well, now they're going to mm-hmm. pull up the ladder because they made it. And I think it's going to be very hard it'll be interesting. The FCC has rules against this. It'll be very interesting to see if they see it this way and if they enforce those rules. Mm-hmm. And I think this is okay, you really want a conspiracy theory? A very interesting play to put the FCC in a spot.
Yes.
If they enforce this, consumers like little Bobby Salsa will say, hey, I want the free internet stuff. You're not looking out for my interests. Because it's harder to understand the deeper principle and the deeper hazard if you don't enforce net neutrality.
I think we should ask, what's his name again? Damn it. The newsroom man and
Will McAvoy? Aaron Sorkin?
Yes, no. Aaron Sorkin.
Aaron Sorkin.
The face of Aaron Sorkin, Will McAvoy. Yeah.
There you go.
He's his mouthpiece.
You could make him write a beautiful speech about why, you know, it's just like why we need to defend the guilty in a court of law so that the innocent can be protected. That is exactly the kind of argument, like working a bad example for the greater good.
One speech Aaron Sorkin will never write, I can promise you. He hates the internet.
You know what I think is scary about this also is that a lot, not to subject people to ageism, but a lot of younger people grew up with not as open of a web. And those are the people that are utilizing a lot of these sites, especially YouTube and Netflix and Hulu. So that's what they're used to. Maybe they don't really remember a time when it was as open of an internet, and maybe they aren't really bothered by it.
Yeah.
Yeah, but they're basically reaping the rewards, right, of that past of like, right, you know, before the broadband era really took off. Like it took us, you know, getting rid of minute fees for internet access and broadband becoming basically unlimited for a lot of people for this innovation to take off. And we're seeing history sort of repeat itself in mobile, right? Because mobile is still dealing with these bandwidth caps. We've pretty much lost the whole dream of unlimited bandwidth on mobile.
Right.
Even T-Mobile, because of this Un-carrier move, they quietly raised the price of their unlimited plan by $15. Now it's $95 a month. So that's the sort of like price you're paying for something like this to happen. You know, it's kind of scary, and I don't know what it's going to mean for like the future of the mobile web.
Jennifer, you wrote about this. You're in New York City. Do you do a lot of you play a lot of FanDuel or DraftKings there? Are you big in the fantasy?
I personally don't.
No. Yeah.
But no, I did write about it.
So the Attorney General of the state of New York, Eric Schneiderman, has said that's gambling and it's illegal. And has shut down FanDuel and DraftKings. FanDuel and DraftKings both have implemented geofencing technologies that prevent users in the... It's a handful of states now that have banned this kind of... Including Nevada, this kind of fantasy football betting. But I've also seen articles that say it's really easy to use a proxy and just go right around them. They're not trying all that hard.
I don't think they're trying very hard at all.
You can't blame them. I mean, it's a big business.
They're pretty upset about it.
Well, they're suing. They've gone after Schneiderman. He sent out cease and desist letters on Wednesday. They've gone to the Supreme Court to throw those letters out. I'm not sure what the grounds are. I guess the debate is, does daily fantasy sports qualify as gambling?
Right. Well, their argument would be, this is FanDuel's argument, was that it's a game of skill rather than a game of chance. So when they go to the Supreme Court, or when they present their case, they're going to present it under the premise that all of these people who win more often have more skills, and they're going to prove that in various ways. And it was interesting, though, because on the conference call, before the operator started, it was only supposed to be press, and before the operator stepped in and cut out regular people from taking calls, they had to answer three calls from fans who, you know, weren't the most kind of educated questions or things like that. So it kind of played into their argument, played against their argument a little bit.
I get, every time we talk about this, I get email from people who say, you don't understand this at all. And I make a lot of money on it or whatever. I don't know what, I actually don't understand their point. I think I understand fantasy football and daily. I mean, I understand that. And it's betting. Like horse racing is betting. But I think, Jeff, you're a good guy to comment on this. Is this debate over, is it gambling or is it a game of skill, really underlie the basic failure of kind of legislating morality in general? Should there be laws against gambling of any kind at all?
Well, a few things there. I think, to me, the most abhorrent form of gambling is lotteries, state-supported taxes on the poor.
Yeah.
I think it's, you know, you watch who buys lottery tickets near me, and there are poor people who can't afford to do that. That's one level. The other level is, now I'll get myself in real trouble, but hey, I think that's why I'm here. You know, after the revelations about FIFA and the revelations about the Russian sports, how much do we really believe that sports aren't rigged every which way?
Okay. Now you threw a monkey wrench into the whole thing.
Yeah, that's what I tried to do.
Is that why it should be made illegal to bet on horse races or...
No, it's just I think we have this presumption that there's some, you know, the great American pastime, that there's some great moral standard around sports.
Well, I don't think the NFL is rigged. Is it?
Well, much of the NFL? How many? And bicycle racing was a pure thing. Rigged by what way? Rigged not necessarily by agreement, but also by drugs, by other means. And
I think you're mixing a lot of different issues there, though, Jeff.
As Gustav points out, there's nothing more rigged than the stock market. It's not illegal, last time I checked. Right?
Is it though?
It's rigged against you. You cannot make money on the stock market unless you're a professional.
Read Flash Boys.
Exactly. It's rigged.
It's rigged with all the computers and robots that are trading.
It's as rigged as it can be. And what's the sad thing about the stock market is it's fueled by this imaginary notion that you as an individual can play a stock and win by skill. Right?
And that's the argument that FanDuel has, is that it's skill. But I actually think that winning on the stock market does require a bit more skill than picking horses or something
like
that.
I don't think you can. I don't think you could have perfect knowledge. But that's the problem. That's what Flash Boys shows, is you can't have perfect knowledge. Somebody who has a faster connection to the internet can have perfect
milliseconds.
Yes. And it's just hopeless. And so, but I don't think, I'll be honest, I don't think any gambling should be regulated. I don't think it should be regulated at all, especially since the state's already doing it with the lottery.
Well, that's the reason the state is doing it. In socialist France, and in most, I think, European countries, the lottery is regulated and gambling is regulated. And the only, it's kind of like smoking. You don't want to do some kind of prohibition because we know how these things go. We've seen many examples, but you still want people to have access to it, but you want a relatively controlled environment for it. And I think that's what it's about. If you completely outlawed gambling, there would be a lot of, it would go underground.
Right. So, but I don't think you should, you can regulate it in the same way that you regulate driving or whatever. You have to be 18. I don't care about that. But I think it's like marijuana laws. It's a vice law that comes from a Puritan point of view that just doesn't. It doesn't. And what you're seeing, this argument shows how it doesn't hold water. Is it a game of skill? Is it not a game of skill? If it's a game of skill, it's legal. If it's not a game of skill, it's illegal. How do you even decide that?
Yeah, and I just got back from Lagos, and in the hotel lobby there, they've got slot machines, and you don't see anybody rushing to it. You go to Vegas, and everybody's rushing to all these things. It's huge because we make this scarcity around it. We make this puritanical rule around it. And you go to other places, and there's casinos
Italy,
all over, and nobody
Italy
goes.
Has slot machines in every cafe. Oh. Right? I don't think
how is something like playing a lottery, a state lottery, or using machines at a casino, how is that legal and not using your brain to at least try to beat the market or pick horses because of their stats?
Well, I think this is a longer conversation, and I think a good one, but I feel like the stock market is perfectly well known that the stock market is rigged, and that people who have inside information, and there are lots of them, are the only people who have a shot at it. But they've got to encourage people to think it's the American way, that you can invest a buck and make 20. And so talk about the con game. That's the con game. Because if those people don't put the buck in, then the other guys don't make the buck. So, the stock market, that should be regulated.
It is.
Yeah, not very well. It's regulated by the people who run it. That's the problem.
Mm-hmm.
All right. I'm going to wrap this up with one last sad note. I was kind of sad that this wasn't more publicized. One of the pioneers in mainframe computing, Gene Amdahl, passed away this weekend at the age of 92. A legend, absolute legend, and a name that those of us who've been using computers for more than maybe 20 years will know, but I think a name that a lot of younger people do
hold
not.
On. Yeah, hold on. Let's do a poll. Who in the panel knows the name Amdahl?
Does that name ring a bell?
Not very well. I've heard it before.
Yeah, you see.
Did he invent the Amstrad? I don't know.
You were trying.
Yeah.
How many of you have heard of Osborne?
Well, you know my.
I know he's a character in the Marvel universe. But,
All right. K-Pro.
Yeah. You had one, didn't you, Jeff?
I have an Osborne 1.
You have an Osborne 1. We do. We had it out for the new screensavers yesterday because we were talking to a guy who sells floppy disks. How many of you have heard of floppy disks?
Okay, that was
my favorite anecdote from that was Ian Thompson who mentioned that somebody had had a diskette, a 3.5-inch diskette, and his little daughter came over and said, "Daddy, you 3D printed the save icon." So that's what's wrong with kids today. Anyway, Gene Amdahl, who was responsible for creating the System 360, the most successful line of mainframe computers in IBM's history. I don't think even mainframe computers even know anybody knows what those are.
We've had a downer show, you know what?
Well, sometimes the world impinges.
I think we have to end on the fact that the Google car got a ticket for going too slow.
24 miles an hour. I love this. Was the self-driving car, right?
Yep. The little one, the little new dicky one.
They have it set so that it can't go more than 25 miles an hour. It was driving in Mountain View, and there was apparently a line of other cars behind it. So the Mountain View Police Department pulled them over.
How do you pull it over?
Well,
there's no control.
Interesting. As the officer approached the slow moving car, he realized that there was no one driving. There was a passenger. So the officer asked the passenger how the car was choosing speeds and informed the passenger about California Vehicle Code 22400A about, whatever, driving the right speed. The self-driving car pled guilty to slow driving because they want them to feel friendly and approachable rather than zooming scarily through neighborhood streets. No ticket.
Is there a robot voice that said guilty?
I am guilty. Yes. Guilty. I am guilty. No ticket was issued, not because there was no driver to give it to, but because the officer deemed no law had been broken.
You know, I think it's good, though, because he was telling Google that them driving too slow was causing these traffic backups. Yeah. At least Google's getting some real world feedback.
What would he have done if there were no passenger?
Call Google. Yeah.
What do you do?
Well, that's the new, what is it? The some of the founders of Skype are doing the little delivery bot.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And if you try to steal it, it'll start yelling at you and saying, "I'm calling the police. I'm calling the police."
I need one of those.
Maybe you just put the ticket under the windshield wiper and hope that somebody gets it someday. This is going to be a scene in next year's Silicon Valley.
Silicon Valley.
Yeah.
I'm still binge watching Humans.
Oh, I got to go back to that. I only saw the first few episodes.
You didn't? Oh, yeah.
Hey, tomorrow on Triangulation, Larry Wall, the benevolent dictator for life of the Pearl Project, the man who created Pearl, joins us in studio to talk about Pearl 6, which is finally here. So Larry Wall tomorrow on Triangulation. That should be a lot of fun. I want to thank you so much for being here. Jennifer Booten from MarketWatch, at MarketWatch, at Jay Booten on the Twitter, marketwatch.com. I hope this hasn't been too painful.
No, it was good.
Good. We had a lot of fun. I'm so glad to have you. We can't wait to have you back. Same for you, Devendra Hardawar from Engadget. Anything you want to plug? Are you up to no good?
I'm always up to no good.
Good.
Engadget.com/home.com for my movie podcast. And you can understand why I hate Spectre so much.
Yeah. Did you talk about that in the most recent Slash film?
Yeah, definitely. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Slashfilm.com. Ridley Scott gives Prometheus 2 a new title.
That's movie news, guys.
Yeah. That's the movie news. I love movies. Gosh darn it. Mm-hmm. And after a week like this, you want to go to the movies.
You should see Spotlight. Spotlight is a great movie about journalism.
Oh, okay.
Can't wait to see it. Yeah.
So what, good.
Is that the best unknown movie out there that everybody should go see? Spotlight?
Yeah, that one hit this weekend. That's the one about the work by the Boston Globe. In the early 2000s to deal with the church scandals and the child abuse issues with priests there. So it's a really talky movie, but it's so good. It's all just right. So tense.
Open and narrow, so it's not out in the burbs yet.
Ah. I want to see the new Whitey Bulger film, speaking of Boston.
No.
No?
Okay. You can skip that one.
What?
Have you seen The Departed?
Loved the Departed.
That's a better Whitey Bulger movie.
That's the best movie ever. Johnny I loved the Departed.
Whitey Bulger.
You never know what's going to happen there. That's a great movie. Jeff Jarvis, professor of journalism, City University of New York, buzzmachine.com is his blog. He also writes a lot on Medium and other places, and he's got books. He's erudite. He's an intellectual. I don't know what the hell he's doing here. We're glad to have you. Welcome back home. We'll see you Wednesday, boss.
You will indeed.
On This Week in Google.
Yep.
And finally, thank you, Patrick Beja. It's probably two
thank
in the
you so
morning.
Much for having
what time is it in Paris right now?
Yeah, it is. It's 2 a.m. indeed. Oy. But you know, it was an interesting and important topic to discuss.
I am so glad you were willing on short notice to pop in and give us.
Thank you, Patrick.
Yeah.
Thank you for having
perspective me. Perspective on what's going on in Paris right now. Thank you all for being here. We do this show every Sunday afternoon, 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern Time, 2300 UTC. I love it if you watch live and join us like little Bobby Salsa in the chat room. But if you can't, in studio, we had a great studio audience. Thank you all for being here. Just email twit, tickets at twit.tv, and we'll put a nice comfy chair out for you. of course, if you can't watch or be in studio during the live show, you can always get on-demand versions of all of our shows after the fact, audio and video, either at our website, twit.tv, or wherever your favorite podcasts are aggregated. We love it if you subscribe, because we want you to be here each and every week. I'm Leo Laporte. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time. Another Twit
is
in the can. Bye-bye.
Doing the twit, baby. Doing the twit. All right. Doing the twit, baby.